is BCFM 93.2, the number one choice for Bristol.
And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Age Broxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Just like in Iraq, we got rid of Libya's so-called evil dictator Gaddafi, but have made things far, far worse for ordinary people. Also, we've got nothing against Ujima Radio, our fellow community station here in Bristol, but what if the very name of the station was founded on a myth? Ujima is a key part of Kwanzaa, K-W-A-N-Z-A-A, which is a fake version of African culture, based on Karl Marx and cooked up in the US in 1966 by a guy called Ron Karenga. He's a man whose group tried to bring down the Black Panthers over there in the 60s. Also, as all eyes are on ISIS in Iraq, whatever happened in Libya, I'm afraid we'll not be joined by a filmmaker because the phone's down here. His film was called Libyan Crisis: Events, Causes and Facts, and we'll try and get him on next week. But anyway, things have descended down into chaos in Libya again, with mysterious air raids taking place by nobody knows who, probably the United States or the Israelis. Also, emergency powers. What power does the government have to take away our rights in a time of crisis? We like to think it couldn't happen here, but under a state of emergency, Britain would become a very different place. Far from explaining this to us, these days government and the media are tight-lipped on the subject, and the Civil Contingencies Act, which is in force now, is far less provision for ordinary people than in the old Civil Defence Act from before 9/11. So we go back to the 1980s, and the BBC broadcast a whole programme about states of emergency. It's called In Time of Crisis. It was made by investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, and everyone was surprised to see how much US forces would be in charge here. But we start, Martin, by looking briefly into this story about Libya, which is a mystery air raid that warplanes came under cover of darkness on the 18th of August, bombing several sites in and near Tripoli, Libya's capital, been associated with Islamist militias. Few Libyans know for sure who's piloting the aircraft or who sent them. Some close to Khalifa Haftar, a former general whose forces have been fighting Islamist militias mainly in Benghazi, the country's second city to the east, claimed responsibility, though the strikes were probably beyond the capacity of Libya's own depleted air force. So what's going on here? We know the country is in chaos now. I mean, it's very, very much worse for ordinary people than it was before our intervention. But who could be behind these mystery air raids?
Well, it's been suggested in the article here from The Economist that it might be the Egyptian armed forces or the Algerian armed forces, both of whom are firmly in control in their respective countries and are not very happy to see Islamists advancing inside Libya. But let's come back to what we've forgotten all about Libya, haven't we? We've moved on to other things, but of course the place is disintegrating, as has been suggested. The Islamic fighting group in Libya, who were the cutting edge of the revolution, are in fact the Islamic branch of Al-Qaeda, and they've been working with MI6, our own intelligence services, for at least three or four decades. Certainly Annie Mashon and David Shaler from MI5, they quit MI5 over a plot to assassinate Gaddafi, which was rooted in this Libyan Islamic fighting group, who were the main cutting force, as I say, in the rebellion of a few years ago. And that rebellion, of course, was not an accident. Operation Southern Mistral 2012 was a war game between the French and British air forces, which just happened to be exactly the same as what actually happened on the ground in Libya. So they got all the planes in place, and then suddenly, blow me down, what was happening in the war game happened, where there was an armed rebellion, a supposed attack by aircraft on protesters, which then led to a situation where the West imposed a no-fly zone over Libya. No Russian no-fly zone over Ukraine, of course, even though the Ukrainian government is using aircraft to attack protesters, whatever you want to call them. Protesters with guns in their hands, same as in Libya, of course.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because one would have hoped that this is the job of the UN Security Council, is to make sure at least that there's some kind of level playing field in conflicts where there is a way of dealing with them, like you're talking about possible no-fly zone. But we're seeing very, very different... should we say, scenarios rolling out in different parts of the world, depending on what the West wants, what NATO wants. Yeah. Also, though, let me just point out, before we leave Libya, the extremist governor of Tripoli, Abdel Hakim Belhaj,
Libya's Islamic Fighting Group.
Yes, he was actually a graduate, if you can call it that, of Guantanamo Bay. He was one of the people who was captured there. Didn't seem as if he'd done too much wrong. But once he'd been through the Guantanamo Bay process, including something that they called, I think, Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, he's now turned into some kind of fanatic. It almost seems like that this is all like the School of the Americas that the US used to have, where Guantanamo Bay is ostensibly a prison, but what it's doing is it's turning out these extreme Islamist fanatics that are then going on to cause all sorts of havoc and mayhem elsewhere. But just tell us a bit about this Penny Lane and what was the other one?
Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane.
Yeah, well, what was all that about? And what happened to these people in Guantanamo?
Strawberry Fields are forever. So if you go to Guantanamo, and you've got, and lots of people are innocent in Guantanamo, they've got no connection with terrorism, but you can't release them because it makes you look bad, so they've got to stay forever. Penny Lane is where people are brought in, and if they weren't working for you already, because they may well be working for you already, so you take them to Guantanamo, but you pretend to put them in prison, then you release them. So Al-Qaeda in Arabia... was set up by two former graduates of Guantanamo who had been held by the Americans, arrived in Yemen, and then set up this new organisation. And I just mentioned the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group earlier. They've had linkages with MI6 going back decades. And we're now talking about ISIS in Iraq. It's quite clear that there's all sorts of reports, and you can check it. They're definitely being funded by the Turks, the Saudis and the Qataris, and they were getting training from British and US special forces 2 years ago. So in actual fact, somebody knows exactly who's trained ISIS, because British forces personnel have been involved in it in Jordan and in Turkey. Now, what we need to do if we want to stop ISIS is find out who in MI6 and the government gave the orders to train ISIS, and then put those people in prison.
It's the Foreign Secretary. You can't execute William Hague because
can't we?
Well, because
Gaddafi was executed without any kind of trial of any kind, and French special forces were probably involved in that.
Look, that is
a crime against humanity.
The way these things tend to work, Martin, is that secret plans are brought to the Foreign Secretary it would normally be the Foreign Secretary, and they will sort of say, "Well, yes, that's okay, but if anything goes wrong, don't say I ever told you that."
Well, that's absolutely true. And, of course, the other thing is that things happen that defence secretaries and foreign secretaries know nothing about. And then they are told to react to things that are... So what's clearly been going on for a very long time, going back to the 1980s, that extremist Islamist groups of various hues have had direct linkages with our intelligence services, highly direct, to the extent of being trained by our special forces. Now... Then of course they run amok, and you say, "Oh, look, these people are running amok. We will have to intervene to stop them." So this is the game. So, for example, in Mali, after the intervention in Libya, suddenly this Islamist group grows up, which takes control of northern Mali, and then we have to intervene to stop them. And of course, they would never have been there if we hadn't intervened in Libya. And everybody thinks, "Oh, this is just a mistake." It's not a mistake. We've ended up with French forces sitting right on top of Mali's goldfields. Oh. How strange that would be. And of course, the area that ISIS is taking control of in Syria and Iraq just happens to be the place where all the oil is. Oh, right. So we'll have to intervene to stop ISIS, which just means that our troops will end up sitting on top of the oil field.
Okay.
Just purely accidentally, of course.
And like I say, before we leave Libya again, Benghazi, it was a strange incident in Benghazi, wasn't there, with the US ambassador was murdered. What happened there?
Well, what one can work out from the various conflicting stories, it was definitely the case that Libyan weaponry, most of it of Soviet origin, was being shipped to Syria via Turkey to arm the rebels, the ones that we're now supposedly fighting. And that was being run by the CIA and by this chap that he wasn't really an ambassador. This guy, in fact, was involved in this process of supplying weaponry on the black market, under the table, to the rebels inside Syria. And basically what the Western intelligence services and the Israelis have been doing all along is stirring the pot. divide and rule as the Roman emperors always used to do. So they're basically encouraging Islamist extremists to undermine their political opponents, like Assad in Syria or Hezbollah in Lebanon, and then they can use the existence of these extremists as an excuse for further intervention. And of course, ultimately, of course, it's all about oil pipelines, resources, control.
Okay. Also, looking at ISIS, just there's various names for it: ISIL, ISIS, Islamic States. The guy who's in charge of that, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he wants to be the caliph, and this apparently is prophesied in the Quran that there will be a caliphate in that part of the world. But he's another one who's been through US prisons. It turns out he's been actually. Not sure of the name of it. It was actually a prison in Iraq itself, Camp Booker. Yes. It's called. He was in there, varying stories from the US military, but certainly for a few years. Looks like he was arrested in 2004 and released in 2009. So he's been through this almost like a sort of graduation school of US prisons.
There's some very interesting.
Is there any point in the Americans sending these people to jail if they're going to come out and then run organisations like ISIS?
Well, that's the whole point. When they're in jail, no doubt deals are done. You play ball with us and we'll play ball with you. There's very interesting pictures circulating on the internet of John McCain, the former US presidential candidate, meeting al-Baghdadi in Syria 2 years ago and saying what a fine chap he was and how brilliant it was that he was going to overthrow Assad. And now, of course, he's turned into public enemy number one. Now, in actual fact, what's going on here? Can't people see how completely deluded the West's policy is? They have been encouraging these extremist groups, and Saudi Arabia is our closest ally. We were talking about Abbey Wood earlier. Filton supplies massive amounts of armaments to Saudi Arabia. That's what keeps everybody in Christmas bonuses up there. At the same time, the Saudis then supply ISIS with weaponry, for which they then try and take over Iraq, and then we send soldiers to try and stop ISIS taking over Iraq. Might be better off to stop supplying weaponry to the Saudis in the first place. And maybe, if we want to get rid of ISIS, we should leave that to the Syrian government and to the Iranians and the Iraqi government, and maybe we should try to withdraw our support for Saudi Arabia.
I mean, it just
That's
seems
the most useful thing.
It seems to me as if sometimes Islamic extremists are our friends, other times they're our enemy, and they keep switching from one to another. When the Soviets occupied Afghanistan, they were our friends. We wanted to arm them under Operation Cyclone. All of a sudden, when we invaded Afghanistan, they were the bad guys, the Taliban. They sort of changed their name. At the end of the day, though, it's very difficult. I mean, and then of course, changing back to being our friends in Syria to try and overthrow Assad, and now again with the death of a journalist beheaded supposedly on video, they're the bad guys again. And it's not surprising, is it, that last weekend the Bishop of Leeds, it slammed the failure of the British government over Islamic extremism in a scathing letter backed by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Church of England delivered a withering critique of David Cameron's Middle East policy, describing the government's approach as incoherent, ill thought out and determined by the loudest media voice at any particular time. The criticisms made in an extraordinary letter to the Prime Minister, signed by the Bishop of Leeds, Nicholas Baines, and written with the support of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, seen by The Observer. This is a report in The Guardian last weekend. It describes the UK's foreign policy as so muddled and reactive that it is difficult to discern any strategic intentions of the government's approach to the region.
Well, what they're saying is, isn't there, because of course the churches are particularly aware of the rebels in Syria's particularly nasty attitude towards the Christians in Syria. The Christian minority in Syria has supported the Assad regime pretty solidly throughout the crisis. So, of course, that feeds back to the Christians. They say, "Well, this is a bit problematic." I mean, my mother reads the Church Times, and of course, in the Church Times, there was an awful lot more about the Christian point of view on the rebels in Syria rather than Assad must go. But of course, underlying all of this, it's not actually muddled policy at all. We have been supporting Islamic extremism all over the world for the last 30 or 40 years. And so we support them, we create them, we allow them to come to power in places like Libya and elsewhere, and then we say, ooh, goodness me, where did those people come from? Now we shall have to invade to stop them. And it's like fox hunting. We breed the foxes and then we chase after them and go tally-ho.
After this letter by the Bishop of Leeds, countersigned by the Archbishop of Canterbury, the government was in a bit of a quandary. David Cameron was away on holiday and they wanted to find a minister who would reply to it, explain it on BBC Radio News and on Radio 4 News. And who should be chosen but our local MP? He's a Communities and Local Government Minister, Stephen Williams. So this was the reply Stephen Williams gave to this letter.
It was an incredibly complex situation, and how you deal with an inter-ethnic, intra-religion conflict in terms of what ISIS are doing by not just being against Christians, for instance, in northern Iraq, but also taking out acts of extreme violence against Muslim Iraqis and Syrians, is very difficult to comprehend, very difficult to know what you need to do about it.
Well, that's really playing a forward defensive straight bat, isn't it? It's very difficult to know what to do about this. So,
in a way, he's kind of confirming what the church is saying, well, is that it's not coherent.
And what I suggest you don't do is you just drop some more bombs, which is the knee-jerk reaction. We should really analyse where these organisations came from. If we were serious about stopping ISIS, then we should go and have a word with the Saudi Arabians and the Turks. Turks are in NATO, by the way. Their chaps are trained at Sandhurst. And say, oh, will you stop supporting ISIS, please? That might be a good place to start. But since we know for a fact that British and US special forces have been working with the Turkish army, with the Jordanian army, with the Saudis to arm and train these groups, we've got a picture of John McCain meeting al-Baghdadi 2 years ago. We've got training camps in Jordan and of course they've ended up with a massive amount of US weaponry from two sources. One, the stuff that was supplied to them under the table, some from Libya, and then of course the Iraqi army melted away to allow them to take over this territory. And the Iraqi army was armed and trained by, the Americans. And so therefore, what it looks like is that the Iraqi army leadership fled into Kurdistan and told their troops to withdraw, leaving their weaponry to ISIS. So, what do we think's going on here?
Okay, this is a very well-funded organisation. The evidence is coming out this week. The Iranian Interior Minister, Abdulreza Rahmani Fazli, has explained that most of the money comes from the manufacture of methamphetamine in a factory that they've taken over, which is being used to stimulate their soldiers as well as to sell as a fundraiser on the world markets. They're also, we're told, in regular contact with Mexican drug cartels.
Well, if that's what the Iranians are saying, I find that rather hard to believe.
That statement was from a former CIA officer.
Oh, exactly. That's what I'm saying. The CIA have been saying that the drug cartels that we're actually arming and training in Mexico are working with the Islamic extremists that we're actually arming and training in Syria. But in actual fact, the real money comes from things like the Saudi royal family. And as I've stressed to you before, British special forces have definitely been involved in training these people. Some people know exactly what I'm talking about. They may be listening to this show. The fact is that ultimately all of this needs police investigations tracing back to the banking system and back to senior politicians and senior secret service people in Britain and the US.
Now,
and those people really have got to recognise that after all of this ballyhoo about how horrible these people are, and they are pretty horrible, we've got to recognise that our own secret services have been absolutely complicit in setting all of this up. And therefore, they should take the rap.
Okay, looking back a few hundred years to something called the Crusades, a lot of people in the Middle East regularly talk about, and not so much over here, Israel as a crusader state. The idea that this is a sort of white people have moved into the area, trying to take it over, taking over with the focus on Jerusalem, of course. And I wonder what you think about this, because there seems to be a similarity to the Crusades in this, in that most of the people of faith, whether any of the Abrahamic faiths that live in that part of the world, just really want the problems to go away. They want to just get on with their lives. Before the Crusaders turned up, various faiths used to get on fine in that part of the world before the Crusaders arrived. And we've seen the same, haven't we, in 1947 when the State of Israel was set up. There's been problems since then. Before that, Jews and Christians and Muslims were living happily together in Jerusalem. It was a completely different setup. So is it a bit much for me to draw comparisons between the original Crusades, back when the people like the Templars went over there to leaving rivers of blood in these cities to take them over, so-called, for Christendom, and what's happening now?
I think that there was never a time when people lived together completely in peace, but there's been definite phases when things have got worse, and the situation for ordinary people have got worse. We're definitely living in one of those phases now. The situation in the Middle East is beyond parody in terms of its seriousness.
Well, it's been getting gradually worse, surely, since 1947. We had a particular step up in that in 1967, in the Six-Day War,
another
for example.
Another particular set up in 2003 when we gratuitously smashed the state of Iraq to suit the Israeli national interest and the oil companies and all the other people involved.
But I suppose what I'm talking about here is a kind of the idea of having a kind of fake version of that religion. I don't think Muhammad is really in favour of the idea of converting people at the point of a barrel of a gun.
Let me answer you. The concept of a caliphate is a modern concept. There was a caliphate in the past, and it carried on as a kind of an institution until the Ottoman Empire, when the Ottoman Sultan claimed to be the caliph. Once the Sultan was deposed, he was no longer the caliph. But in any case, many people didn't. It was a large, you know, lots of people didn't accept the concept of a caliphate. And I think that the ISIS have been deliberately created by Western puppet masters, and that we're now talking MI6, CIA, to be a reactionary travesty of Islam. The whole Wahhabi regime in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis were brought to power by the British and then came to do a big oil deals with the US. And they are, in fact, an offshoot. They're a modern creation. The four schools of Sunni legalism, which are all considered to be compatible, the Wahhabis reject all of that. They want to go back to the Quran, which, in fact, actually cuts out the whole Sunni concept. So they're not even real Sunnis. They are extremists, modern extremists. And, of course, the creation of nasty Islam, where people's heads are cut off with penknives, supposedly in this video, a penknife is used to cut somebody's head off. Somebody should try that with a rabbit and realise how difficult it is. The video's quite possibly faked. Who would fake such a video, and to what end? That's a real question. That you can't see that video online now, so it's impossible to get hold of it. So we're all just got to take it on trust that it does show what they say it shows. But we just don't know. When we know that in Benghazi they were supplying weaponry, but they claim not to be. The chemical weapons attack in Ghouta this time last year. All the evidence compiled by people like Simon Hirsch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, point the finger firmly at the rebels working with the Turks and the Saudis. The Turks and the Saudis are our allies. Yes, the Turks do training at Sandhurst. So do the Saudi army. And they were the ones behind the chemical weapons attack that killed so many people in Ghouta supposedly last year. So we are being played for fools. But I think the contradictions in the Western policy should strike even the stupidest person. So this time last year, we're told we've got to bomb Assad and bring ISIS to power in Iraq. And now, 180 degrees turn, we're going to support ISIS, but we're not going to have anything to do with Assad. It reminds me of National Hate Week in 1984, where they changed the people were supposed to be hating in the middle of National Hate Week. And this whole thing has gone way beyond any kind of control. And what we're dealing with here is runaway gangsterism in the secret services, and that definitely includes MI6.
But what about this idea, come back to this idea of conversion at the point of the barrel of a gun?
Well, what if you actually look at the history of the original, there were no guns, point number one. And the point is that the vast majority of people, when they were taken over by the Islamic forces, the Islamic forces didn't force people to convert. They didn't want them to convert. What they said to them, there was a lot of persecution of different minorities. And when the Muslims took over, they said, as long as you're a Christian and Jewish, you're a people of the book, we don't want you to convert to Islam. You've already got your religions. But what you must do is pay a special tax, which will pay for us to be the military force which will control the situation. So when the Muslims were in control of Jerusalem, Christians and Jews were protected minorities. They didn't have the same rights as Muslims, but they certainly didn't try and convert them either. What actually happened is, as Islamic rule was established and the benefits of Islam were made clear to people, and not least, you know, social preferment and so on, because the Muslims were the ruling group, everybody wanted to convert to Islam because they wanted to join the bureaucracy, they wanted chances and opportunities for their children, and Islam was actually quite an attractive religion. So in actual fact, the vast majority of people converted to Islam absolutely voluntarily.
It sounds to me
resistance from the original Muslims. Yeah. That we don't want all these Johnny Come Latelys joining our religion.
A much more successful way of winning over hearts and minds than we've seen with the British and the American Army in Iraq, for example.
Well, don't forget that the British and the American Army, regular armies, are going in there to create to deal with a mess that the Secret Services have already created. We have created this monster of international Islamic jihadism, and it was actually under the glorious reign of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And there will be people alive today who got medals and pensions and pats on the back for the fantastic job they did in setting up this international Islamic brigade to fight in Afghanistan and defeat the evil Russian communists. And then, of course, it all turns sour. And this is presented as blowback. Oh, what can you do? Osama bin Laden used to work with us and then he decided he was against us. I don't believe that for a minute. Most of these very extreme groups are being run by Western intelligence services, the Israelis and MI6 CIA. And of course, genuine liberation movements, Muslim-based liberation movements like Hamas and Hezbollah, they are the real target. In other words, people going about, there isn't just one kind of Islamic extremism. What you have got is genuine Islamist movements which have genuine support, and they are being undermined by extremist minorities being manipulated by the West.
Okay, what about the question of radicalised youth in Britain going over to fight for ISIS, for example?
Well, we were told that the rebellion in Syria was by people in Syria who wanted more democracy, and then it turns out that there is British people are over there fighting with ISIS. Well, do you know how I think they got there? I think they were recruited by MI6 and inserted in there. And it's great, isn't it great, that we've got probably some, what the accent that we've heard, it sounds like some West Indian chap, probably from parents from Jamaica or St. Kitts, Nevis. And he converted to Islam, and then suddenly he's in Iraq and Syria, killing people with penknives. This smells to me of MI6 psychological warfare techniques. And MI6 in particular were the lead agency on Operation Cyclone. So it's not just something that the nasty Israelis and the nasty Americans do. The British, very much involved in working with these groups over the years. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example, who have got a long track record of working with MI6. And that's why London was called Londonistan at one stage by the French police force. Because during that period, we, MI6... they recruited all of the most extreme jihadis from all over the Middle East, from Libya, from Algeria, and they all set them up in London, which is why they're still here.
So,
and then, of course, these groups then recruit young boys, and then they end up in Syria.
So if, MI5, MI6 are creeping around in Bristol trying to recruit people for these kinds of activities, what should people do if they come across this kind of thing?
As I said at Birmingham Central Mosque a few years ago, Tony, they should talk to local police officers they know and trust. Have nothing to do with the intelligence services, because they are, in fact, the manipulators behind the scenes of all of these groups, in my view.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're going to have a look at an excerpt from a book called Secrets and Lies by David Southwell in his section about cults and secret societies. The false claims, he says, about Kwanzaa, a holiday invented by a former convict and now celebrated by millions of African Americans. When Bill Clinton took up his second term in the White House, he became the first to support the celebration of the African American religious festival Kwanzaa. Speaking about it, he said, "The symbols and ceremony of Kwanzaa evoke the rich history and heritage of Africa. It's a vibrant celebration of African culture that transcends international boundaries. Kwanzaa is in fact nothing of the sort. It's an invented festival for a religion based not on African culture but upon Marxist principles and created by Ron Karenga, a man who used to be a radical advocate of black separatism and who tortured women. A 7-day festival starting on December the 26th is promoted as an African American alternative to Christmas. It's claimed that it's based on 7 ancient African principles, said to symbolise the 7 principles of blackness, and that it takes its name from a Swahili harvest festival. First created in 1966, it's now celebrated by more than 12% of African Americans, who may be surprised to learn that the principles, including Kujankelia, I'm sure if I've properly pronounced that, but that's self-determination, Ujima, which is collective work and responsibility, and Ujamaa, cooperative economics, derived from Marxism, not from African culture, that no African people celebrate a harvest festival in December, and that some of its symbols, such as Muhindi, that's ears of corn, are not even native to Africa. Before coming up with the spurious festival and its accompanying religion, Quaida Karenga had been a member of the United Slaves Organization, a radical black power group that was in violent conflict with the Black Panthers. In 1971, Karenga was convicted of felonious assault and false imprisonment after torturing two women from the United Slaves who he thought were trying to poison him. During his trial, the prison psychiatrist reported that this man presents a picture which can be considered both paranoid and schizophrenic with hallucinations. Quite understandable, then, that George W. Bush continues to follow Clinton's tradition and give a presidential Kwanzaa message. This was written back when the Republican president George Bush was president. It's rumoured that fans of the cartoon Peanuts are now lobbying for a similar recognition of the tradition of the Great Pumpkin, distributing gifts to good children on the 31st of October.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Well, we're going to have a look now at emergency powers and state of emergency. We've got something now called the Civil Contingencies Act, and that replaced something around about the time of 9/11. I think it was just literally just after 9/11. The Civil Contingencies Act was brought in to repress something called the Civil Defence Act. But Martin, but the Civil Contingencies Act has much more of a focus on things like property and integrity, not less. In fact, things like air raid shelters, fallout shelters in case of a nuclear war for the public are totally out the window now. The focus is almost entirely on how to deal with property now.
Well, I mean, what we were talking about a minute ago about the manipulation of terrorism all over the world, Islamist terrorism and otherwise, the purpose of this is to allow the state or the secret state to aggrandise itself at the expense of the society. So, for example, we saw the so-called US Patriot Act passed within a few days of the 9/11 attacks. It's a massive document. It's about 8 volumes, I understand. It must have been written over many, many years and very carefully calibrated and rushed through on the nod as soon as the terrible terrorist attack by the outside Islamist forces had managed to blindside the entire US national defence system. You wonder why we spoke talking about spending money on defence earlier. None of it was the slightest good on 9/11, supposedly. The Air Force did nothing, etc. But of course, immediately you then passed the Patriot Act, which is actually very carefully named. It's the Protection Against Terrorism Something Something Act. So in other words, even the name of the act is designed to bamboozle the public. And the Congress passed it without even reading it. And of course, it gives huge powers to the secret state. Fantastic. So crash, bang, wallop, shock and awe, we're now in complete power to do anything we like because you've just passed the law saying that we can. And of course, when we were talking earlier about the Foreign Secretary and the Defence Secretary, they won't necessarily be in the loop. So an attack happens, they're then told you've got to sign up for this, otherwise the sky will fall in, and they're as panicked as everybody else, and they just sign up for it.
The last summer we had the Ghouta attack, chemical weapons attack Damascus, near Damascus, and there was a very strange event, and that was the firing of two cruise missiles from somewhere in the Mediterranean towards Damascus were both brought down by the Russians. The question is, nobody seems to be aware as to whether that attack, which could have started quite a shooting war between the Syrians and those various powers in the Mediterranean, mainly the Israelis, the British and the United States, but nobody's actually aware whether that was authorised by the President of the US, the President of Israel or the British. Two missiles are shot down, which could have started a war, but they may even have just been simply fired by the military.
Well, I mean, there are various theories floating around about it. I mean, one of them is that they were fired by the Israelis, and the Israelis said, we're just testing the missiles. That, as I understand, is the official story. Whether that was what happened, I have no idea. But I think people need to really wake up and understand that we are being pushed down the road to a world war, and not just in the Middle East, by forces within the Western power structure. They're not necessarily answerable to the political leadership. The political leadership is massively compromised in dealing with them, and many of the political leaders don't. I mean, we heard Stephen Williams there earlier saying it's very difficult to know what to do. Well, it is if you don't know what's happening and you haven't got any clue what's going on. Incidentally, Stephen Williams, our Liberal Democrat MP, voted to go to war with Syria last year. If he'd had his way, we would have been bombing President Assad, who has actually won the presidential election in Syria with a massive vote, not that the West has bothered to recognise him. And, of course, it's his people that have been fighting the Islamic State all the way, who have been armed and trained by our own special forces. I'm quite certain of that. If we ask serious questions, we will find British forces were involved in arming and training these people. Now, if we want to do something to stop ISIS, the first thing we should do is find out who in the British Armed Forces has been working with them and punish those people severely.
Okay, now let's go back now to 1987 to a BBC documentary called Secret Society, and this was one of the episodes called In Time of Crisis. Incidentally, the broadcasting of this series back in 1987 was so controversial that it looks as if, it almost as a direct result of this, the Director General Alistair Milne, who was really the last really good Director General the BBC ever had, he was replaced by Michael Checkland, who wasn't even a programme maker, he was an accountant, and then by John Burt, and we all know what happened there with John Burt's reforms of the BBC. Martin, you know, what your thoughts are about the way that some of these laws have been brought in. We've had, for example, another one is the Public Inquiries Act has completely changed the way that inquiries into terrorist attacks are done ever since the 7/7 attacks.
Well, the process is simple. You've got your secret services working with terrorist groups. In recent times, this has been Islamist terrorist groups, but in the past it was other kinds of terrorist groups, such as the fascist terrorists in Italy, and other left-wing groups like the Red Brigades, for example, were infiltrated. So you're actually pulling the strings of these groups. They then carry out terrible atrocities, like the bombing of Bologna Railway Station in 1980. You then step forward and say, we've got to do something to stop these terrorists. Look at all these terrible things going on. You've got to give us more power so that we can catch the terrorists, which we set up in the first place. People in Eastern Europe know how this works. It's the sort of thing that Stalin used to do in a rather crude way. But, of course, the Western intelligence services are much more sophisticated than that, but they still kill lots of people.
I'm afraid we're going to have to drop that item for the time being, and let's have a listen to something different, which is an interesting little release this week. It's a programme called The Changes. It was made by the BBC Bristol as a children's drama back in 1975, and unbelievably it's never been released on DVD. It's one of the best programmes the BBC ever made, in my view. A lot of it is filmed in and around Bristol, quite a lot in Totterdown, over at Clearwell Caves, over just in into Gloucestershire, over the near the other side of Chepstow, The Changes is all about a strange society where machines are considered suddenly evil. A strange noise comes through people's homes, and it's the film shot in Bristol. And so let's have a listen now to some of the clips from The Changes, three little clips. And the star of the show is a little girl called Nikki Gore. She's a teenager who's at school, and she finds that she's trying to go off to school, and she can't because people around Bristol are smashing up machines, televisions, cars and things like that. The reason I'm talking about this is because it's actually finally due for its release, not by the BBC, but by the British Film Institute this week. So let's go and have a listen now to some clips from The Changes. And you'll hear now Nikki Gore, that's the character's name, coming back from trying to go to school, only to find that her parents are packing up to leave the city.
Oh, it's a school. It's all closed down. What are you doing?
Packing.
Isn't safe to stay here. People are going mad. The house could be attacked. We're going to try and get to the south coast and then to France. They say things are still all right there.
How are we going to get to the south coast anyway? It's miles. And there isn't any transport.
And in the next clip, you'll hear the noise, which is what everybody hears when they see anything technological.
Eyes and hold on to the prel. We'll lead you through.
is when Nikki Gore goes near the big power pylons. They're awful, they frighten me, they're wicked and dangerous, and that's the effect that the changes have on Nikki. Also, she's hiding somewhere a little bit later in the series, and she's tracked down by this guy called Davy Gordon, who thinks she's a witch because she's hiding near machines.
There's something in there, Peter. You and I will go in, Peter. You boy, wait out here and cut it off if it gets past us. Right. Come out and show yourself, whatever you are. Come on out of it. I know you're in there somewhere. A witch, by God, a witch. Hey, Peter, come and look at this. We've got ourselves a witch. Get her out of this wicked place. I knew there was some real wickedness going on here, Peter, and here's the cause of it.
You quite sure about her being a witch, Davy?
Well, what else could she be? There's no ordinary human person would hide so near them wicked engines. Don't you see? She was trying to get the evil thing started.
I wasn't. Really, I wasn't.
Be quiet, you. I'll have a chance to speak later at your trial.
Trial?
Yes, lad. She's got a fair trial, just like anyone else. Right, be heard before they're sentenced. She'd get a trial, all right. Come on, Pete, let's get back down to the village, get things organized.
They're mad. Grown men believing in witches? But she's younger than me, I should think. What will they do to her?
God knows. Davy Gordon's capable of anything. If there's anything evil around, it's an imp. Look, you go back to the house, and I'll go to the village and see what happens.
All right.
That was some clips there from the BBC 1975 children's sci-fi series The Changes, which is due for release by the British Film Institute on the 25th of August, that's next week. And very, very, I'm excited to hear it because I've been actually watching it for many years, hoping and waiting. It's actually adapted from Peter Dickinson's best-selling trilogy of novels, The Weathermonger, Heartsease and the Devil's Children here in Bristol by Anna Holm, who was later to go on to be the chief executive of the Children's Film and Television Foundation.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, being better by actually getting the audio clips for you. And this one, as I was saying earlier on, is about the Civil Contingencies Act, or the previous version of it, which was called the Civil Defence Act. And it's investigative journalist Duncan Campbell, who's done a lot of reporting on GCHQ, for example, with the Edward Snowden revelations more recently. And this extract is called from a documentary from 1987 called In Time of Crisis. Most surprising to see just how much power the US will have if we do have a state of emergency here in Britain.
Duncan Campbell looks at the government's emergency laws and the contents of the draft Emergency Powers Bill for use in time of crisis.
It's more than 20 years since NATO planners decided that any future conflict could not be an all-or-nothing nuclear war over in a few hours. So the new NATO strategy has made the extensive use of civil resources vital to military mobilization. But Whitehall's opted not to discuss the implications. In secret, though, they've agreed dozens of plans for resources to be allocated to meet the US requirement.
Absolutely critical. There is no question, but it is one of the major wartime tasks of the United Kingdom is to be ready to receive massive amounts of material and personnel and to move them efficiently into the combat zone.
The U.S. Air Force itself, in official evacuation plans for U.S. bases in Britain, says,
"Here in England, we're in the front lines where the action is."
The last time Britain was in the front lines was September 1939.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note.
Shortly before war was declared, a secretly written Emergency Powers Act was suddenly produced by the government and rushed through Parliament. It gave the government authority to take over any resources it needed, conscript labour, and imprison people it regarded as dangerous. There was no time for Parliament to scrutinise the terms of the new laws.
That no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
A few months into the war, the new laws were found to be too severe, so Parliament quickly reduced the government's special powers. The new laws are only partly based on what happened last time.
Well, it seems as though a lot of the basic provisions are obviously similar and draw on experience from the Second World War. But in many cases, they seem to go a lot further and envisage much more sweeping powers for the government, particularly in a time of real crisis, of going far beyond powers that were taken in the 1940s.
Just as in the 40s, thousands of American troops would be coming to Britain, but much more quickly, needing more from us. 15 years ago, secret negotiations began on the Americans' requests.
Total commitment. In other words, for every plan we made to reinforce and resupply, there had to be host facilities to receive the material, transship it, secure it, protect it, so that it was expected that every host nation was going to meet all of those requirements fully and promptly.
That sort of requirement can't be met without new legal powers. So at the Home Office, special official committees on home defence have recently been supervising the preparation of the new war laws.
In the last 6 years or so, this government has embarked on a sort of major programme of rejigging the whole process and has produced a whole series of new bills with new powers and in different orders and so on, so that the whole system has been modernised and brought up to date.
On the 15th of October 1983, this senior civil servant was given a special assignment in the Home Office. Last year, Peter Harvey finished writing regulations to implement the new emergency laws. But Parliament isn't allowed to know. When MP Archie Kirkwood asked about Mr. Harvey's work, all the Home Secretary would say was that,
"I do not think it is helpful to discuss the contribution of individual officers."
So we checked the Home Office's internal directory, which MPs aren't allowed to have. Mr. Harvey's there as a legal consultant performing special duties with F6 Division. That division's only legal job is war emergency legislation. Number 10 have been equally reticent. The Prime Minister's refused to admit that any draft emergency laws existed, let alone newly written bills.
It will be for the government and Parliament of the day to determine the content and introduction of any such measures. It is not a matter which Parliament need address now.
But why should the government want to conceal the new laws from MPs?
Well, I think they might be somewhat surprised at the degree of power that the government proposes to take, even quite early on in a crisis.
Widespread anti-nuclear protests have made war planning a sensitive subject round Whitehall. But we've talked to officials who've seen the new bills. They're already printed and could go to Parliament tomorrow. Today, they're stamped secret. There's going to be three bills, the first one to be passed very early in a crisis. It includes controls on public order, selective arrest and internment. Members of some army units have already been trained to run internment camps.
It did actually quite shock me to quite a large extent, because I'd never ever realised that was the type of thing that the TA was going to be used for.
One type of internment camp was to hold suspected saboteurs. An island on the south coast had quite another role.
This was a different type of internment camp. It was more for a mass of people, not for individuals.
What kind of British people were supposedly being picked up in this exercise?
Obviously people such as pacifists, politicos, etc. were major targets. They were people that would be singled out for special treatment.
Were you under any doubt that this was a dry run for the internment of British civilians?
Absolutely no doubt about it at all. That's what shocked me about it.
Certainly, if the Civil Contingency Act comes in a state of emergency of some sort, Martin, it's going to be a very, very different state of affairs, isn't it?
Well, except that these things are going on already, but we're not being told about them. In many ways, you don't even have to pass laws to do stuff, do you? When you've got a runaway intelligence apparatus doing pretty much what it wants, they can disappear people anyway without bringing in legislation.
Well, the interesting thing is that there is a real problem in Britain right now with oversight, as we've seen with GCHQ doing all sorts of things it shouldn't be doing. Mm. There's a large amount of evidence that it's actually criminal offences that they're committing by stealing passwords, hacking, basically. Mm. And the person who's supposed to be overseeing it all is a certain former Tory Defence Secretary and now an MP. He's the chairman of the Intelligence and Security Committee, Malcolm Rifkind.
Yeah, well, as I said before, Malcolm won't be what he doesn't need to know. He won't be told. The fact is that I think we've reached the point now where organisations like the CIA and MI6 have to be broken up completely.
Well, but
we've got to start from first principles. Police principles, police accountable police forces like the Police Service of Northern Ireland, like the Italian magistrates, need to go in and break up the US and British intelligence.
Rifkind is saying,
I put a lot of people in
this
prison.
Today and yesterday, Malcolm Rifkind, Sir Malcolm Rifkind, Chairman of Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee, is saying that we must join Assad to defeat ISIS.
Well, I think it's interesting that Danet, the former head of the army, was saying the same thing. And, of course, it just shows the contradictions in the policy that they're trying to pursue. I mean, the Americans have now said, oh, no, we can't possibly do that. And in a way, but what might be happening there is that the British are basically flagging up that it's impossible for us to ally with Assad, so we can't do anything about ISIS. So that may be the positive spin you could put on it. But the fact of the matter is, as I said earlier, there's overwhelming evidence that British and US special forces have been training ISIS personnel, which is probably why these people are John Paul, George and Ringo inside ISIS. Isn't it strange that that these Brits aren't so high up inside ISIS that they're looking after foreign prisoners? It makes you question, well, who is ISIS? And as we saw earlier, al-Baghdadi's shown in a photograph meeting John McCain a couple of years ago in Syria. The whole thing has turned into a pantomime, but a very dangerous and horrible pantomime for the people who live in the region who are having a horrible time.
Now, if we go back a year from now, it was this horrific chemical weapons attack in Ghouta, and I want to make a little critique now of the BBC over this, because I'm going to let you hear now a couple of clips from BBC reports at the time, which show that the BBC have actually been editing interviews to make them, it's impossible to tell which is the genuine version, but one is certainly been edited to deceive, and so I would ask you to have a listen to these two clips from of the different versions of the same interview from the BBC, and listen particularly to the words of the female doctor that's talking about her experience of the attacks as they happened.
Among the medics here was a British doctor visiting for the charity Hand in Hand.
I need a pause because it's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of, I'm not really sure, maybe napalm, something similar to that.
Last month, we were filming the doctors working at this hospital when victims of an incendiary bomb attack on a school playground started pouring in. Their burns suggested the bomb was filled with a napalm-like substance.
It's just absolute chaos and carnage here. We've had a massive influx of what looked like serious burns. It seems like it must be some sort of chemical weapon. I'm not really sure.
The point being, Martin, in the first of those two clips, she says it seems to be some kind of napalm. I'm not really sure. The second clip, she says it seems to be chemical weapons. I'm not really sure. But it's the same interview. It's just been edited.
Yes, and of course BBC Russia went into East Ukraine a couple of weeks ago after the shooting down of the MH17 airliner, interviewed people, locals saying they saw the plane shot down by Kiev's fighters. It was then put up on the BBC Russia website in Moscow, and then suddenly BBC London went mad and said, take that down. What happened to that report? Basically, the BBC has become part of the psychological warfare operations of groups like MI6. And it's because of the BBC's reputation that it's used in this way. The Guardian has also been used in this way. So we had The Guardian, The Telegraph and the BBC claiming last week that a Russian convoy had gone in over the border into Russia. Do you remember, we were talking about that this very time last week. And it turns out now, no such thing. So who in The Guardian, the BBC and The Telegraph said that they'd seen this Russian convoy? Because it ran and it caused a quiver on the stock market. Some people made a load of money, and now it's all disappeared down the memory hole. The use of TV stations as part of psychological warfare is very far advanced. So, in other words, interviews are doctored and so on. But of course, in the days of the internet, what these psychological warriors have got to understand is we will deconstruct in real time your lies. And so, for example, the MH17, all of the evidence is piling up. The Malaysian press know it was shot down by Kiev, probably working with CIA MI6. So all of those people, Dutch, Malaysian and Australian, who were killed, killed by our own intelligence services. What are we going to do about it, folks?
Well, that's the national BBC, but here at local BBC, I was hearing this week from an insider there that actually the BBC phone-ins, I mean, even though they've got a broadcast area at BBC Radio Bristol of something like 500,000, that their phone-ins in the morning are actually not phone-ins at all. Some of them are actually phone-outs. So when they do a subject and people don't really have much of an interest and the lines aren't lighting up, and I used to do this job down at BBC Radio Solent at Greater London Radio, you'd always make sure that you were picking a subject that people wanted to talk about, and then you'd find the lights would light up across the screen as people phoned in. This isn't happening up at White Ladies Road some mornings, and so rather than have a phone in, they're phoning out. They're saying phone X, phone Y, because no one's phoning in.
Well, that's the problem with all sorts of media, isn't it? It's basically a theatre, and some of it and the ethics involved are extremely dubious. We've had the whole business of the Leveson inquiry, etc. But of course, what's really dangerous in situations like Ukraine and Syria is we are being fed war lies, very similar to the lies that were pushed at the beginning of World War One and World War Two. The Gliwice incident in Poland, the Belgian massacres, etc.
Now, this is all coming to a head very soon, isn't it? Over as NATO gets together over the river in Newport.
That's right.
Next weekend, I believe.
Next weekend, NATO are coming to Newport next week. On Saturday, there's a big demonstration against NATO in Newport, assembling in the centre of Newport on about midday on Saturday. And there's a counter summit on Sunday in Cardiff.
Okay, Martin, thanks very much. That's all we've got time for now. We shall be back next week. We'll be talking about the NATO summit and also having a look at 9/11 before I have a couple of weeks holiday. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That's the Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. This programme's online. You'll find a lot of links up there on thisweek.org.uk. And you can follow me, Tony Gosling, on Twitter too. Don't let the banksters get you down, and have a good bank holiday, even though it's going to be raining.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Malky Mackay has been speaking publicly for the first time since allegations emerged he was involved in racist, sexist and homophobic texts while manager of Cardiff. He and former colleague Ian Moody are being investigated by the FA. Mackay has admitted sending a handful of messages disrespectful of other cultures and has apologised, but he says the headlines of the past few days don't paint the right picture.
I am no racist, and I am no sexist, I'm no homophobe, and I'm no anti-Semitic. The people that know me know that, and I do understand that it's the people that don't know me that I've got to convince of that.
The former head of the British Army is warning the West may have to form an alliance with Syria if it's going to tackle Islamic State militants. Lord Dannett's suggestion has been ruled out by Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond, though, who said it wouldn't be practical, sensible or helpful. But foreign policy expert Dr. John Bew says something needs to change.
We are responding to crises on the ground as things have happened.